Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, and welcome to today's program with the Commonwealth Club for the Bay's future. New solutions to the housing crisis. I'm Erica Aguilar. I cover housing at KQED News. Please join me in welcoming today's speakers, the housing experts, and an enjoyable conversation about what we can do to help solve this crisis. To my right, Janet Liang is the president of Kaiser Permanente Northern California and is an active community steward, having served on numerous community boards supporting education and socioeconomic development. Fred Blackwell is the CEO of the San Francisco Foundation. Since joining the foundation in 2014, Mr. Blackwell has led the foundation in a renewed commitment to social justice through an equity agenda focused on racial and economic inclusion. Dr. Priscilla Chan is co-founder of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, a new kind of philanthropy that pairs engineering with grant-making, impact investing, policy, advocacy work to help build an inclusive, just, and healthy future for everyone. Pastor Paul Baines is the co-founder and president of Project We Hope. And as the wealth and opportunity gaps in the Bay Area economy widen and deepen, Pastor Baines is continuing his lifelong commitment by helping the most marginalized individuals and families achieve stability and build toward a more promising future. Finally, we have Dr. Jennifer Martinez. She is the Chief Strategy Officer for PICO California, the largest faith-based community organizing network in California. PICO California supports the development and action of grassroots leadership to advocate for racial and economic justice. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today in this conversation. It's an honor to be here with you. All of the panelists have been on the front lines of the housing crisis for years here in the Bay Area. And all of them are also members of the Partnership for the Bay's Future, a new regional effort launching today, with support from the San Francisco Foundation, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, the Ford Foundation, Local Initiatives Support Corporation, Facebook, Genentech, and more, many, many more. We're here to discuss the solutions to the San Francisco housing crisis, and honestly, across the state, and I would say across the nation, we're seeing it. The pool for the need for housing, the economic burden, the widening gap. We're all here to talk a little bit about that and to try to find solutions, to leave here empowered and to feel like we play a role and we can solve this together. So thank you so much for being here, for being able to be engaged. I'm really excited about our conversation. It's an honor. Especially today, I will say, in a few hours, there are going to be hundreds of volunteers along with government service workers out at midnight counting some of the most vulnerable people in our population, people who don't have homes, who are sleeping on the streets, in vans, in tents, in cars. I'm going to be one of those people who are volunteering, counting people. It happens across California about this time. And Pastor Baines, I wanted to start with you to help us sort of set the framing for our discussion today. The faith community has long been a protector of these people in need. You guys are on the ground serving the most vulnerable. Help us identify what are the challenges to making sure people who are homeless, people who are on the edge of homelessness, have a roof over the head and can keep it.
What are the challenges? Well, from my experience, and I'm going to say this from my faith, God's not making any more land. And no land, no landing. If we don't have the land to house the homeless, all right. Now, I'm a Pentecostal preacher now, so. if the challenges are we need land. Mm-hmm. We have the systemic problem in marginalized communities, which typically are communities of color, where those land is not owned by the people there in that particular city. And so therefore, they can never end generational poverty, and they end up being homeless because of the outside pressures of the constraints of not being able to afford to buy their own house, or now to even rent their own place. So income is a problem, is a solution, and land is another problem that can be a solution.
I feel like churches, a lot of faith organizations have experience in setting up shelters, soup kitchens, and using their own land to provide some of those services. How can some of the rest of the industries and sectors in our community learn from what the faith community is doing and having helped through shelters and different services like that with their own land?
Well, if you look at the landscape of any community, and I'm East Palo Alto, we're 2.5 square miles, the biggest landowner is typically going to be a school district, or it's going to be the city or the county. But the next biggest landowner outside of the residents is going to be faith-based institutions, whether it's a temple, a synagogue, a mosque, or a church. And so those are prime examples of where partnering with the cities, partnering with the foundations, private-public partnership, of where that land could be better or additionally utilized, I should say, for such things as housing. Those are a great opportunity for a synergistic approach to address a systemic issue in these marginalized communities.
Fred, can I get you to jump in on this a little bit? Because we know that's one of the elements of the CASA Compact that we know recently about, because you guys have just presented the compact to some of our cities, and one of the elements is finding government-owned land to help find places for housing.
Sure. And I'd love to talk about CASA, but I did want to piggyback a little bit on what the pastor has lifted up there around the issues related to income and land. And I would add race to the mix here. I'm in philanthropy now. Most of my time was spent in local government. Most of that time was spent in local government in San Francisco. San Francisco is a place where there are not enough African-American people to actually fit into the old Candlestick Park. And that was the dynamic when I was working there in the kind of mid-2000s. So I often say that, you know, the housing crisis has reached a point where it's no longer somebody else's problem. Everybody is feeling it in a very intense way. But black folks were the canaries in the coal mine in the Bay Area. They were yelling and screaming and kicking their feet around this issue a long time ago and feeling pressures around gentrification and displacement. And what's really tragic and maddening about it is the fact that that is a result of very deliberate policy practices, land use decision making, decisions about who has access to capital. And so what that means is that the solutions have to focus in on those things. And we can't just think about this as a programmatic problem. This is a systemic problem. If you look at the folks who are in tents, who are homeless, you see a wide diversity of people there, but you also see a disproportionate number of African-American people in those tents.
One of my colleagues at KQED said her daughter was driving through the Mission and said, "Mom, why are all the homeless people brown?"
Yeah. And, you know, people use this analogy a lot, but I think it applies here. If you were sitting at the end of the river and you kept seeing kids coming down that river, babies coming down that river, would you just continue to stand there and pluck them out? Or would you look upstream and see what's happening upstream to put those kids in the river? And we're not doing that. We're not going upstream to figure out what's creating the complexion of what we're seeing when it comes to those who are the most vulnerable in this situation.
Well, that leads me to this question, and I wonder, Jennifer, if you can help me out here. How do we address this racial discrimination that we're talking about right now against black and brown people with some strong housing policies that can help people who are marginalized find affordable places to live?
Wow. That's 30 seconds. I think we have to face the history that has created the conditions we're living now. You know, we talk a lot in the Bay Area, and I think now this conversation is starting to happen across California and other metropolitan regions of the country, where we're looking at global capital in the form of the tech industry or banking or whatever it looks like as the, you know, kind of causal factor for some of the housing crisis we're seeing. But the reality is that this moment and this condition is set upon a blueprint that was created 75, 100 years ago, that created a lot of the circumstances that Fred is talking about. And unless we are willing to radically recreate our institutional systems that are perpetuating that dynamic, then we're going to continue repeating the lessons of the past. And so, you know, that has to do with we need to strategically and prioritize investment in communities of color for communities of color on their terms, not on the terms of folks from outside of those communities. We need to be able to protect people in place while that process of development happens. We need to be able to create housing at a level that is actually affordable to people. Right now, what is considered to affordable in the Bay Area is somewhere in the neighborhood of a family of four that makes $115,000 a year. Can you imagine? That's considered to the start of the affordability range and lower. That is not what we are seeing in vulnerable communities is even achievable. So we need, and then beyond that, I would say we also need to like look at the communities that have historically been exclusive, that have historically kept people, low-income people and people of color out of their communities, and put a burden of responsibility on them to answer for that history and to start to create new policies that will enforce housing in their communities as well, force housing to be in those communities, in the same way that housing is now being put into vulnerable communities.
I want just to add, as we're talking about the unseen, and just to raise awareness that when we think about homeless individuals, that over 30% of the homeless individuals are seniors. Right? They're over 50 years old, and it's pretty tragic to think that's where you've ended up in life. And that 17% are teens, and 50% of the teens were rejected from their families for being LGBTQ. So it's broadened. It's become more pervasive, and somehow in our society today, we've permitted this sort of really inhumane way for vulnerable individuals to find themselves in, and it's time for us to do something, which is why I'm so pleased to be here in this partnership work. It's time for us to do something together.
I just want to kind of piggyback on what Dr. J has said here. I know we put it under the guise of affordable housing, but I like to say ELI housing, which is extremely low-income housing, because you have market rate, you have affordable, you have low, you have extremely low. We need more extremely low, because that would be for the working poor. That would be for the homeless. We can't leave them out of the equation. That's what's causing our the oppression and oppressive state and climate that we are in currently causes them to go to those emergency rooms because they have no place to stay.
And so, I saw that in Orange County when I was reporting on homelessness. Some of the people who were homeless were dying, not because, you know, they were overdosing. Well, some of them were overdosing. But mostly what it was is they were underlying health conditions such as heart disease or diabetes. And simply because they did not have access to a roof where they can care for themselves there or support services. And I bet, Dr. Chan, you probably see some of this as a pediatrician in some of your work and Janet as well.
Yeah. I've...
in my work at San Francisco General as a pediatrician and running a school in East Palo Alto, neighbor to Pastor Baines, I've seen kids who it's incredibly difficult to get their asthma under control because they live in a garage and the air quality is poor, or kids who sleep through all the afternoon in preschool because they have nowhere to sleep at night. They're sleeping in a car. And so I think these are very real impacts on our future, that it all stems from a common denominator of poor housing. And I think we all want to make sure that we are taking care of the most vulnerable individuals in our population. And in the Bay Area, we are in a troubling situation where it goes much beyond that, actually. And we are, in the school in East Palo Alto, we're having trouble recruiting teachers to live in the area and
because
serve.
They can't afford there.
They can't afford there. It. They can't afford to live in East Palo Alto and serve the children that we know we all want to make a difference in the lives of. I'm sure Janet sees nurses, physicians, actually the infrastructure that makes it possible for us to serve those that we care for, firefighters, all incredibly hard to actually recruit to the Bay Area and serve and build that diverse, caring community that we want to exist. And so I think it really has come to a point where we all need to get together and really think about that complex, comprehensive solution that we need in the Bay Area for everyone to thrive, especially the most vulnerable.
Well, Janet, I wanted to pivot toward you to talk about this idea that housing is a form of healthcare, and find out if you found any solutions or models that you admired and liked.
Yeah, you know, we last year we launched a $200 million fund called the Thriving Communities Fund to address preservation and protection for housing. And when we did that, we had people ask us, so why are you know, why is Kaiser Permanente getting into homelessness and housing? How is that in your wheelhouse? And we said, you know, for us, the topic of housing security or insecurity is fundamentally a healthcare issue. And you said it, without food on the table or a roof over your head, taking care of your health seems a luxury, right? So, and I'll give you some statistics. You know, we know that individuals that suffer from chronic homelessness in and out of their lives have a 9% higher mortality risk than the general population. And that results in 27 years less of life.
Wow.
27 years less of life.
That's an entire...
Chronic homelessness, yes.
You know, exactly. That's you're going through school, grade school, and well, heck, you're finding the love of your life, maybe.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about, and, you know, there are people in cars, there are people in the stress. Can you think about the emotional
yes.
stress of worrying about keeping a roof over for your family, or you're living in a car and your safety? I know many, many churches have opened up their parking lots for people to park overnight. That, you know, there are a lot of unseen people who are really struggling, and it all manifests itself in chronic disease and inability to heal yourself physically and mentally. And so it is a healthcare issue for us. And when we looked at the encampments, there are many encampments that are forming now, and you know, there is widespread, not widespread, but you can, there is a higher rate of communicable diseases. So we saw that in Southern California with the norovirus outbreak, in the camps. And so it becomes also a public health issue. So many reasons why the healthcare industry needs to own, and we felt we needed to be really vocal and lead in this space, that the healthcare system needs to be a voice for change with housing and homelessness.
I want to linger in this topic a little bit just because... as I told you guys all, I'm gobbling up Nadine Burke Harris's book, The Deepest Well, on childhood adversity and how these stressors early in your life can manifest itself in diseases like asthma, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis. Jennifer, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. earlier in our conversations before, you talked about having had to deal with, and I share this, instability early on in your childhood, or maybe in your life before, with the unknowingness of having a home or a steady place to be, a steady place to live, a steady place to learn. I wondered if you could share with us some of your experiences and what you've learned from that, and how that helps you in what you do now.
It's only recently that I started thinking back, because for the past 20 years, my professional life has, in one way or another, been about housing. And only recently I started thinking back about, you know, my growing up life and my family life, and realizing that housing has informed almost every dimension of that. Whether it was, you know, my mom being a house cleaner and my dad working odd jobs in construction, or the precarity of not knowing, are we going to be able to make rent this month? So being able to say that, you know, I believe very deeply that housing is not only a very personal thing, and that's why maybe sometimes it also gets tense and emotional when we start talking about what are the solutions to this housing crisis, because it's one of the few things that everyone has some kind of proximity to, issues, public issues, right? And it's personal. And at the same time, it's so interconnected to so many aspects of our social lives, our collective lives, whether it's health, whether it's the way policing is conducted in neighborhoods, it's the criminal justice system and how criminal justice system treats different people who live in different neighborhoods differently, whether it's whether you come here as an immigrant and what your status is and your ability to get access to housing. In so many ways, housing is and of course, education, where we can get to go to school, where kids go to school, where resources are coming from to go to school. So in so many ways, this problem is having ramifications across people's personal lives, but also in all of our lives as a community and as a society. For us not to see it in that light and to treat it as units of housing only would lead us, I think, down an insufficient path.
I love that you said that, units of housing, because it's, you know, as a reporter, it's what I look like too when we're looking for data, right? We're looking like, how many units will this project produce? And sometimes we go into the phrase household, right? Which is another way to say, AKA family, right? Or people. And I mean, maybe it's just a commentary, but sometimes I wonder if we should be changing our language and how we talk about housing, you know, in terms of units versus family and people in households.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting that you say that, because it feels like that was one of actually the breakthroughs in the CASA process that you talked about a little bit earlier. You know, I want to acknowledge Steve Heminger from MTC, who you know, had the courage to pull the CASA process together, and also Michael Covarrubias, who was a co-chair with me, and Leslie, who's not. But, you know, what was, I think, really important about that process was that there were three things that were acknowledged. One was that housing is a regional problem and therefore needs regional solutions. The other is that to get to the kinds of solutions that are needed, it requires all hands on deck across sectors and across different interests. And the third was that as a community, we spend a little bit too much time in our own silos coming up with our own solutions and don't listen to, talk to, or negotiate with people who have a different point of view. And so what CASA intentionally did was bring together people who agreed that there was a problem, but disagreed, and sometimes disagreed pretty vehemently about what the solutions are. And what has come out of that is a recognition that, yes, the dominant narrative that had been kind of driving this was important, that we have a supply and demand problem, but that it's so much more than a supply and demand problem. And so the P's that were mentioned in the video around protection, preservation, and production, and the recognition that if you're going to kind of facilitate more production, that you have to do more to protect people who are currently vulnerable to displacement or in a housing situation that is fragile, that those have to happen together, and that one without the other will not get us to the right solution. So I think that the powerful breakthrough with CASA was the recognition that all these things need to happen at once, and it's not just about units, it's also about people, and it's about preserving what we have in terms of affordability. And I think, you know, the more detail that we got into, the more clear it was that there was still disagreement.
Yes.
But obviously, that other piece of it in terms of the organizing frame was a very important breakthrough.
Well, the framework and the agreement that there is a problem and it is touching all walks of life and that we have to do something about it. I want to incorporate some of our audience's questions, and this one has a little bit to do with this. And Fred, you might be the person to answer this, but also Priscilla, maybe you as well. Our listener asked, the partnership on and CASA seem to have a great deal of overlap. How will the two work together to achieve common goals?
I will start there, and I'll start with the partnership before I go on to CASA. What the partnership seeks to do is really kind of capitalize on some of the momentum that was created around CASA from a policy point of view, and see if the kinds of relationships and partnerships that have been pulled together can act as kind of execution or supporting some of the elements of CASA, and really seeing if the framework there can be one that we can move on. There's a lot of overlap, not only in terms of the way things are being framed, but in terms, the reason for that is because there's overlap in terms of the people participating as well. And so I think that that's important. I think that the CASA, many of the things coming out of CASA are going to require some pretty heavy lifts in Sacramento and some legislative action. I think what the partnership seeks to do is work more kind of at a local level, at a financing level, see if we can get more private money into and private interest into the stream, and see if there are things that we can do to incentivize, you know, various corners of local government to do more and do better about housing.
I was going to say there's a fourth P could probably be politics, and you know, we are fortunate to live in an area where we have well-meaning, passionate elected officials and people in various agencies, but there is a lot of silos between city, just the way the infrastructure is built, city and county, and the way they interact with our organization, social organizations. And so somebody has to be a convener. Somebody has to be a fire starter, right? And I think this is what's so wonderful about this partnership and this, the Base Future Partnership. You're acting as a way to bring everyone together and to create a common place to support, convene, but also, I hope, agitate a little bit, right? We want to agitate a little bit, because part of this is about, how do you make this a priority? How do you make this a priority for the Bay Area? And I think this is what this partnership can do, and bringing resources and bringing talent. So it's not just about complaint language, it's about collaboration and leadership. So we were working on a we call it a surge, you know, strategy, where because the issues are so complex and it's so a multi-year issue to fix, we said, what can we just do today simply? And we said, there's 500 people over 50 with a chronic disease in Oakland. Let's get them housed by the end of the year. And we're doing some very different things that it was really hard. People are really nervous about it and concerned, and you know, and I got into that space, you know, where
what were they nervous about?
Peak comes out. Well, how can you prioritize one group over another? And you know, what if you only temporarily get someone off the street? What if it's only for 6 months and a
relapse.
Year, and it's not relapse? I said, yeah, 6 months in a bed is better than 6 months on, you know, under the bridge.
Snaps to that.
Right. So I said, you know, you have to start mobilizing just to show people we can make a difference.
Yeah.
And every person we help is an effort worth made. And so I just love the three P's. It's just spot on. on, and we're really excited that this is going to be a catalyst to help bring everyone together.
Well, I want to circle back to something Fred said. In the cost compact, like elements 9 and 10 are the bones of what makes up the regional enterprise, which is basically the money and the power of it, right? I think that's something that the partnership is trying to make happen. Priscilla, can you expand on that?
Well, I couldn't agree more that this is a complex problem in which there is no silver bullet. If there was one solution that just needed money, like this, that it would not be the longstanding pervasive problem that we all see housing to be. But the great thing is about the partnership is groups coming from business, coming from faith-based organizations, coming from organizers, coming from philanthropy, all coming together to build a movement that has longstanding power to really stick to the problem and see it through. This is not something that's going to be solved in the next few months. And so how can we actually all come together and do our piece of moving the ball forward and making sure that we actually have homes for our most vulnerable, for our teachers, for our firemen? And I think one place where we want to be very careful and cognizant is that we are all individually small, but when we come together and actually work together, we can achieve things that are greater than the sum of our parts. And as a philanthropy at CZI, we remind ourselves of that all the time. But what can we uniquely bring to the policy fund or the investment fund that's differentiated from the public sector, where the cities and counties throughout California have committed hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, to this issue. Mm-hmm. Like, what can we actually add to the equation? And I think there's the power of the people organizing together.
The power
of people actually organizing together. And also, from the CZI perspective, we have the ability to take risk and to contribute capital that traditional banks may not be interested in. Or companies have the ability to contribute to the policy fund. And so we are excited about the ability to take some of the risk off the table for more people to be able to come and join in this movement of actually being able to build a diverse community in the Bay Area.
This brings me to another question that we got from our audience. Microsoft has made quite a statement by investing $500 million in affordable housing in Seattle. How do we get the Bay Area tech companies to take a similar lead of responsibility?
Anybody?
I laugh because no one here runs a tech company.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll take donations at the door.
Audience participation time. Right? Well,
Pastor, you want to?
Yeah, I look at that. I think it can be done. What I think Priscilla was speaking on, really none of us is as strong as all of us, is the bottom line. And when we take that synergistic approach from different perspectives, different socioeconomic statuses, I think that will be comprehensive enough that it will get the people's attention. If you look at the civil rights movement, they didn't have email. Mm. They didn't have all this tech, but yet they made a big change in this country and even in this world. In the words of Margaret Mead, never think that a small group of people can impact the world. It's the only group that ever has. So it's seeking to understand, to be understood, to address the issue.
I think what they're asking, though, is like, what role is the private sector playing to help this housing crisis, in terms of as you said earlier, Priscilla, being able to take that capital risk sometimes?
Yeah. And I think we are seeing a lot of interest of actually tech companies standing up and That's wanting right. to be involved in this issue. I was talking to a few folks before this, and I would say 2 or 3 years ago, nobody would say the word housing. It was unclear, unsafe.
That's true.
And safe? Sort of a third rail word, if you would agree, Jennifer.
Oh, yes. I've spent many years trying to convince companies to say that housing was a problem and we needed to do something about it.
Yeah.
And what would they say?
I mean, nobody wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
It was just like not, you know, not our problem.
Not our problem.
And we're in a moment where Microsoft is standing up and saying, like, we want to contribute. And, you know, Facebook, Genentech are a part of this partnership. And there's a lot more interest. And so the amazing thing is it's their capital, which is so helpful, but also their voices. They are important constituents of the Bay Area that they've been driving the, a lot of the Bay Area economy, and now wanting to be a part of the solution for a problem that is age old. And how can we actually harness their power and voice and capital to be a part of this? I think we're just cracking open the beginning of what's possible once we can actually all sit down and actually be on the same side of the problem and like actually say, what can we each do in solving this when there is no silver bullet?
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Jennifer, you want to join in?
I also saw Pastor Baines flag it.
ladies first. My daddy taught me right.
I think community, and particularly agitated community and organized community, has a role to play here, because it wasn't until we actually were organized and agitating that we were able to get into those kind of conversations with Facebook as a starting point, which I think is, if I'm not mistaken, how we got the partnership idea kind of off the ground in a way. Mm-hmm. And that came to out of months and months of negotiation of what was the company going to do for the vulnerable communities that it sits within.
Did it just take nagging or like having conversations over and over, having the right kind of language?
It took the threat of a lawsuit and the ability and willing partners there, because we also threatened lawsuit with them 5 years before that. So it wasn't like that was the only part of the equation. Persistence. But, you know, willing partners within the company. The Google campus is being built in San Jose.
Right.
It's going to be enormous. It's going to have huge ramifications for not just San Jose, but the region. Communities have been working to get them to the table to commit to something bold and audacious in the way that Facebook and CZI have, and I'm not sure where that stands. So it's going to take a lot of inside in those relationships, but it's also going to take organized community.
Can you have growth without displacement? Is that possible?
There are almost 500,000 vulnerable families who are vulnerable to displacement today in the 9-county Bay Area. It is an enormous need that I cannot, and they are unprotected, meaning that they are now currently living at the whim of the market. So should we not address that in a deep way, they will continue to live at the whim of the market.
Pastor, did you want to piggyback off that, and then Fred?
I wanted to say, to me, it's, I think, something that Fred alluded to earlier, is that we're not asking why. Basically, why are we in this predicament? Why wasn't that at a conversation with the tech companies? And so, you know, talking about the elephant in the room is, you know, there hasn't been a inclusiveness at the higher levels with the hiring practices.
Right, we've seen that throughout decades.
People, and so if you start there, you start having a diverse board of directors, diverse leadership of organizations and large companies. Those people of color will be very sensitive to the very communities that they probably grew up in.
Yes.
That they were able to pull up their own bootstraps and get elevated.
Right.
They'll have a different insight and perspective to these issues. And so when you start to look at inclusiveness at the higher levels, it will filter down to the lower levels. Until then, we are going to continue to organize and beat those drums out there so we can get the attention we need.
I love it.
Thank God we got some good ears.
Well, I love what you're saying, because you know, it happens to me even as a journalist. When we talk about homelessness as in terms of education, we know that educators have a different way of categorizing homeless children. And I remember working on a story once, and they were like, wow, you know, if we consider overcrowding and four people to one room, that's considered homeless. And I was like, yeah, because that was my family. And I almost look at the editors. I'm like, wait, why are we reporting on this now? Like, I thought we already knew this, but it turns out they didn't because, well, heck, I wasn't in charge.
They're still not counted that way. That's still not counted as homelessness.
Right. Well,
it's still, and that's 100% a form of homelessness that's undercounted in the Bay Area.
Fred, you wanted to get in.
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in a family of activists, which means I spent a lot of time in community meetings growing up. And I developed a theory during that period, which is the meetings really start to get good near the end. And I think I think we're starting to move into that part of the meeting. And the reason I say that is because I love what Microsoft has done. I love what the corporations who are part of the partnership are doing. And I like the fact that corporations generally in the tech sector are starting to step into this. But I also very firmly believe that this can't be a voluntary movement.
Mm. That's right.
And what that means is that I'm not a person that thinks that, you know, simply changing the tax system is the silver bullet. But I do think that corporate contribution and philanthropy is important. But I also think we need to have a really tough conversation about taxation.
Amen.
And how that fits into this equation as well, because it can't just be voluntary.
Right.
Before I move on to our next question, Janet, did you want to get in?
No, only that you raised yet another impact on lifelong kind of health, which is, you know, living in a crowded unit as a child can become a lifelong health issue. As we know with adverse childhood events, that they can become a lifetime of health impact on children. We know that early childhood adverse events will impact your health status as an adult. So it begins very early on, and it becomes generational as a result.
Well, as we continue this conversation about the role that private sector does have in helping us solve the housing crisis, Microsoft, even Kaiser Permanente, as you talked about, I sort of saw some of these big announcements of the last couple of months and thought, wow, is the private sector filling this role, the federal role, the government role, that has basically given up on ensuring that the development of affordable housing continues in this country? Do you think that that's where we're at?
Well, government's got to be open first.
Yeah.
That's good. True that.
And then I think this is an important conversation, because I think that while philanthropy and corporate sector involvement is key, it can't supplant the role of government. And the role of government is actually really essential. And I would be concerned, frankly, if we started to move to a place where we were relying on corporate sector contributions in order to address public issues like this.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We need to be careful.
Right. We all have a role. I was going to say everybody has an important role, and it's a collaboration. So no one gets to opt out here.
Let me bring in another audience question. Given the connections between land use, housing, and transportation, what are some solutions to congestion that prioritize public transit over putting more cars on the road, whether autonomous vehicles or transportation network companies, Uber, Lyft? Who wants to try to help that? I think, Fred, you might be the best person to help us on this one.
Uh-oh. Well, you know, I'm a city planner by training, and
yes,
I will never forget my first transportation planning course where the professor told me you can never build enough lanes to satisfy demand. Mm.
I feel like that's my life growing up in Texas. All
and
the
so,
lanes.
I think that we need to invest in public transit in a way that we have refused to, and infrastructure that we have refused to, up until this point. And as we invest in transit, we need to invest in housing at levels of density around transit that alleviate the issue. But again, we have to couple these production and these kind of conversations about how we facilitate more development with strategies that are about protection, because a lot of the transit nodes that we talk about, a lot of the transit stops that we're talking about are places where that have been disinvested for many years. It's places where low-income people and people of color have lived for many years, and the solution should not be to move them somewhere so that other folks can be close to transit.
Well, they're the ones who are going to be driving into the cities and working the service worker jobs that are often, 29 hours, so that you're not quite full time, you know. know this from experience. Those are the folks who are going to be driving into the city centers. Wouldn't it make sense to help them get to the transit centers where they can use the low cost public transit to get to their jobs?
The only other thing I would say here is that the reason why we have the mismatch is because we have allowed certain communities to be gung-ho about the accumulation of jobs in their communities and to resist building housing. When you have the jobs far away from the housing, it creates this transportation problem that we're talking about. And, if I had a magic wand, it would be... that we have had communities that have done what I just described, who have used exclusionary tactics to keep low-income people and people in general out of their communities, who have been allowed not to build housing while they've been allowed to attract jobs, and they've been able to do so with absolutely no consequence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if I had a magic wand, I would change that dynamic.
Yeah.
All right. That takes me to this question here from our audience. How can we ensure that the community groups who are advocating for affordable housing actually get preference to live in this new housing that eventually gets built or preserved, especially when those groups represent communities being displaced already? Jennifer, Pastor, I feel like you guys are most experienced.
Yeah, I mentioned that I've been doing this for almost 20 years. My first project organizing a community was at 18th in Alabama for the affordable housing development that's now there. It's about a 250-unit development. And we had about 200 people involved in that campaign over the course of 5 years. It took a really long time. And when I came back to that community a few years later, I discovered only 6 people had gotten access to that housing.
What?
6 people of the folks that had worked to make it happen.
Yeah, who'd put in sweat equity.
Yeah. So there's a couple things. One is there's just not enough. Every unit of housing has thousands of people on the wait list for it.
Yeah.
There's just not enough.
I mean, look at the voucher lines.
Yeah. Secondly, we need to be able to figure out like what community preference really looks like. Mm-hmm. And some folks are starting to figure that out. We haven't figured it out yet. In the meantime, 5 years of work, half the community was displaced by the time the building even opened. So how are we also making sure that communities get to stay in place versus having to go find them 5 years later or 10 years later to say, hey, you want this unit now?
By that time, they've established themselves.
They've gone to a different place. So, again, it's a complicated question that has no one silver bullet answer, but there are components that we need to be able to figure out. Pastor Baines?
Is there like a policy that you guys have seen that sort of has worked to allow people who are being displaced to stay in these new pieces of housing?
Well, I know that I've heard something about, and Maurice probably could probably elaborate on it further, that there was something in Harlem where I don't know if it was Jeffrey Canada or they had 40% inclusionary for those people that were there. And it got passed, it got built, and it got done. So I believe there are models out there where that can occur. I know in Oakland that a faith organization in that city, they developed a large facility, and they were able to get those neighbors in that community, about 80% of them, into that building. So there are ways and models that are out there where it can be done. Again, it's about having that conversation, but I think it has to also start at the policy level. Because if you don't start at the policy level, all these will be one-offs. And we want to address the systemic issue of this housing crisis. And so we have to go down those parallel tracks.
I wanted to talk a little bit about housing crisis or the housing problem, the cost of affordability, not just in California, but other places. I spent part of my summer in 2017 in Tijuana researching and reporting on the, like, I would call them the unsexy issues of growing cities, like wastewater treatment plants, pretty unsexy, land use roadways. But while I was there, I met a lot of Californians, San Diegans, who were actually given up living in the U.S. because it was so unaffordable for them, that they bought a house in like Playas or the Tijuana, you know, and then just crossed the línea, you know, to go to the other side and to work there. I met a post office worker who is a post office worker for the U.S. government in San Diego, but then goes home every night to Tijuana. And then I also spent, I mean, I'm from San Antonio, Texas. All of my family is in San Antonio. They will be there forever. Most of them, except for my dad, are renters. And I'm starting to see, when I was working in Austin, a lot of Californians who had said, I'm giving up California's affordability, and I'm headed to Austin, and now I'm moving down to San Antonio. And personally, I'm frightened for my family, because I don't think, I'm probably their safety net right now. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, is California, is the California housing crisis exporting itself to other parts of the country, to other parts of the border? And what happens? I don't have words because I'm frightened.
Well, like I said earlier, my personal and professional goal is disrupt generational poverty. In order to do that, you got to have some home ownership. Or you have to have some extremely low income where people can still have a good quality of life, living around their neighbors, living around their relatives. And the concern is that we are afraid of one another. We're afraid to have courageous conversations about these types of issues. And so therefore, we kind of kick the can around, or we kick it down the road, or we throw something that, like you said, is sexy, and we'll that'll be the new buzzword for this year or this month. In the meantime, in between time, we have the people who are suffering, who are living in their RVs, who are living in the cars, who are living on the streets. But we can't give up. You know, my message is we never retreat. We only reload with more love. We reload with more persistence and things of that nature. And we still come together. We still organize. We still fight the good fight of faith. And we get the attention of people and organizations that are sympathetic and empathetic, not just sympathetic, but empathetic to addressing these types of needs. And we just have to continue to forge forward. And if we stop the conversation, we leave here, we have this great show and dance and all that kind of stuff, and then we leave here and we don't do anything. This has been planned for 18 months, you know, and so they're in it for these three organizations and all the other associations. They're in it for the long haul. We just need more people to join being part of that long haul.
Also, the unsexy that you're talking about when you saw in Tijuana exists in California, and it's really about inequities. And, you know, East Palo Alto had trouble accessing water for development. And it sounds absurd. East Palo Alto is in the center of Silicon Valley, but could not build or develop because of lack of access to water. And that's in part of the Bay Area not thinking and acting as a region. It's like this community has access and that community does not. And so how can we really think through how to address these issues and actually solve problems as a region and move everyone forward in a way that really evens out some of the structural inequities, including access to water in our own neighborhoods that exist in California?
Used to be the internet in the 90s. East Palo Alto was not connected to the internet.
That's insane.
You know, and we're not alone in terms of being the Bay Area. It's not unique to Bay Area.
No.
You know, there are other urban cities, and there is a an association of U.S. mayors that come together to talk about housing and with community partners and organizations. And I think there's some opportunity through this partnership to connect with some cities who've had some success. I mean, New York City has a really great story about work they've done over the past decade. And so there's, and Chicago did some work too. So I think it's, I like looking at them because there's some, it's possible. It shows you that it is possible to address housing.
Jennifer, you wanted to get in, and I know you have expertise in the cities.
Well, I just wanted, I wanted to just draw some caution about this idea that, you know, Californians are going out and pushing out. It is happening in this flow. I'm getting calls from the Central Valley, of course, here in California. And then we know people are leaving to go to other parts of the country. But it obfuscates the structural problem that we face, that we have in this country, really. I mean, the last time we had a housing crisis was when folks are coming back from the war, right? And the federal government took made active choices to invest enormously, not $1 billion, not $500 million, but hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars to house people coming back from the war.
Well, certain people.
Certain people. And that's
people.
Where I think we also have to be really clear that structural racism is preventing that same response by our state and federal government. When we're seeing a slower burning crisis emerging, but it is happening, and not only in California, and not only because of Californians going other places, but because of the way that the economy is reorganizing itself in all of our cities and all of our metropolitan places. And in the year 2030, I think 65% of all people on the planet will live in a city. And we do not have an imagination for the kinds of urban areas that we need to be creating together. Our imagination, at least in the United States, is stuck in 1950. We need to have a new imagination that's about 2050. And that's the goal we should be aiming for.
I want to squeeze in one last audience question. Gosh, I wish I could be in conversation with you guys like forever. It's so much fun. Thank you guys for participating. This one comes from our audience. It's directed at you, Fred. they want you to elaborate on what you meant by, quote, tough convo on taxes.
Ah. What I mean is... There are a few dimensions to what I mean. You know, one of my trustees at the San Francisco Foundation, Bob Friedman, is over here in the corner. One of the things that he talks about, and he's actually in a movement of people who think about what the pastor was talking about in terms of assets and wealth. Our system of taxation contributes to the concentration of wealth in this country. So one dimension of this conversation is that conversation. Another dimension of this is about California. You know, I grew up in Oakland, and I remember as a young kid the conversations about Prop 13. And I remember I went to public school back then. I remember what public schools were like back then. The kind of investments that were there, and I look at them now, and it's not the same. So we have this third rail in California around Prop 13 that there needs to be a tough conversation about as well. Third, the way that our tax system operates actually incentivizes the behavior that I talked about a little bit earlier, which is to get cities to scramble for how they can get sales tax and get ways to bring in revenue for that tax system without bringing in people who are a drain on revenue. So that is out of balance as well. Then the last thing that I would say in this regard is that we do have to have a tough conversation about taxing corporations and whether or not we have the right tax structure set up there. You know, there were things that happened at the national level around tax change and tax reform that I think created more of a problem there. And we need to figure out that part of the equation as well. But what I want to say is that that has to be part of a comprehensive discussion, though. So I don't want to just go down the road of just having a tax conversation and say that the answer to all this is taxing corporations more. I want us to have a comprehensive conversation that includes that part of the conversation.
Very good. Before we wrap up, I want to give you guys one last question around Robin sort of thing. To sort of help us look to what we can look for in the future, I guess I would ask, and I'll start with you, Janet, give me an indicator, a piece of data, a number, or something that you're using to gauge if California is on track towards some type of solution that is going to break this housing crisis. Is there something that you're watching that sort of indicates to you that we're on the right track?
Availability of affordable housing. Housing is the most impactful thing to solve for homelessness.
Fred?
Fewer people paying more than a third of their income towards housing.
That's a good one. Priscilla?
I would say the unlikely conversations and number of hard conversations that we're having about these issues.
Something like this.
Yeah.
Pastor Baines?
Out of business.
I'm sorry? Out of business?
I run a homeless shelter and homeless programs in four counties and 14 cities. Put me out of business.
Yeah.
No need for my services.
I can't follow that, sir.
She's my colleague for 20 years.
All of the above. The fact that we are even having this conversation, I get a little teary-eyed sometimes when you work on an issue for so long as we have, for almost 20 years now, and to remember when it was a corner of a neighborhood conversation, and then it was a city, maybe a citywide conversation, and now we're finally having the really needed regional conversations that are about structural change. Like, oh my God, structural change. So maybe the indicator is that a couple years from now, we'll still all be getting up in the morning ready to do the work. I know for myself that the only thing that gets me up in the morning is the hope that it's possible.
Amen.
Beautiful.
A round of applause for our panelists today. Thank you guys for joining us and having these tough conversations, for going there, for allowing me to push you there. And thank you guys for joining in and participating with your questions and the organizations and the leaders that make up the new partnership for the Bay's future and to the Commonwealth Club. We thank our audiences who are joining us on the radio, on live stream, and on television, online. I'm Erica Aguilar, housing reporter for KQED News. Thank you so much.
Good job. Good job.